NTSB releases new information on the plane crash that killed U.S. Senator Ted Stevens. This is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 21st of April. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, new data shows the STD rates in Alaska are shockingly high, especially among Alaska Native women.
For chlamydia, there were 6,026 cases, which will pop us into number one in the nation for chlamydia rates.
Those stories and more coming up on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
New information released Wednesday by the National Transportation Safety Board indicates that pilot Terry Smith was in control of a plane that crashed last year, killing him, Alaska Senator Ted Stevens, and others. The NTSB data indicates that the airplane, a de Havilland Otter, was not, quote, cruising at impact, but was climbing and maneuvering. The NTSB had investigated whether Smith's health played a part in the crash. Smith had been grounded by the Federal Aviation Agency in 2006 because of a stroke that he had suffered. Smith was piloting the de Havilland that crashed near Dillingham on August 9, 2010. He was 62 years old at the time. NTSB investigators did not reach conclusions about what caused the crash in the hundreds of pages of data. A 5-member NTSB board is expected to decide officially next month if Smith's health may have been a factor in the crash. According to the NTSB records, Smith had a family history of strokes. It is the job of the board to pinpoint the cause of plane crashes as to mechanical failure or human error. Smith had been given clearance to return to piloting by the FAA. The NTSB investigation also looked into how Smith was given medical clearance to fly. An environmental group has given formal notice that it will sue the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to list Pacific walrus as a threatened or endangered species. A spokeswoman for the Center for Biological Diversity says the group will sue to move walrus off the agency's warranted but precluded list. The agency announced in February that walrus need additional protection from the threat of climate warming but could not be added to the threatened or endangered list because other species were a higher priority. Rebecca Noblin of the Center for Biological Diversity in Anchorage says the agency has not demonstrated that a walrus listing is precluded by other listing proposals or that progress is being made in adding qualified species to the list. New numbers being released from the Alaska Department of Health put Alaska at number one in the nation for chlamydia and number two for gonorrhea. And the reports say Alaska Native women are being disproportionately affected. Dasha Eaton from member station KDLG has the story.
I went to the clinic and it turns out I have gonorrhea. You probably have it too. It can be serious.
Man, what am I supposed to do?
That's a conversation the Alaska Department of Health wants more young people, especially Alaska Native youth, to start having. It's from a recent State of Alaska STD public service announcement, and they want more young Alaska Natives to get tested too, especially for chlamydia and gonorrhea. That's because Alaska is now leading the nation in rates for those two STDs, and the numbers show the STDs are hitting young Alaska Native women hardest. Connie Jessen is the STD program manager with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium in Anchorage.
In 2009, the gonorrhea rate rose by 69%, and about 67% of those were among Alaska Native people. And in general, it affects Alaska Native women at a disproportionate rate. As far as age groups are concerned, the gonorrhea is really particularly among 20 to 24-year-olds. And if you look at it since 2008, you know, in terms of women, it amounts to about an 89% increase. So we definitely know we have a gonorrhea problem.
This week, the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services is releasing two bulletins detailing those increases. The bulletins put Alaska at number one in the nation for chlamydia and number two for gonorrhea. She says they started seeing the increases over the past couple of years. The state declared an epidemic earlier this year.
It is an outbreak. At first, it was more considered of an incidence because they were looking into, you know, verifying whether or not these are true increases or whether it was sort of a surveillance bias in terms of how much screening has been done. So has there been more screening to account for all this increase? And that was something that the state did in Southwest Alaska, and they realized that, no, it's actually a true increase.
Jessen says nobody's really sure why there's been such a big spike in the STDs among young Alaska Native women, but she says they think statewide it has something to do with Alaska having a really young population.
In Alaska, the median age is a lot younger than in other areas of the nation. The median age for Alaskan Native people in 2000 was 25.7 years. The overall median age was 32.4 years. They are more likely to get infected because of a lot of different reasons. Some of them might be biological. That adolescents are usually more susceptible to infections, so there's some of that going on.
Susan Jones is the program manager of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services HIV-STD program. She says the state is also trying to figure out why the STDs are increasing in Alaska Native women. One thing they're considering is that it might have something to do with Alaska's remoteness and the difficulties that presents with testing. The biggest increases are being tracked in rural communities in southwestern and western Alaska in the YK Delta, Norton Sound, and Northwest Arctic tribal regions.
It could be that the native populations that are in more remote areas don't have access to partner services that help control an epidemic. That is less likely to happen where a program doesn't have the resources to go out into the remote communities and find people and get them tested and treated.
She says the bulletins being released this week show that overall, gonorrhea and chlamydia case numbers and case rates continue to climb for all Alaskans. There was a 23% increase in gonorrhea case rates in 2010, and for chlamydia, they increased 13%.
In 2010, there were 1,273 cases of gonorrhea reported to us. For chlamydia, there were 6,026 cases, which will pop us into number one in the nation for chlamydia rates.
Jones says chlamydia is always hard to track because it often displays no symptoms. And gonorrhea is also getting harder to identify because the strain going around Alaska seems to display fewer symptoms than usual. The state's trying to stop the epidemic by offering something called expedited partner therapy. Jones explains.
That's where if a person who has an infection comes in and sees a provider, the provider can not only give the person that has the infection medication, but can give medication to that person to give to their sexual partners. That's called expedited partner therapy. That's where the partner doesn't see a provider, but somehow is able to get the medication. Different agencies and providers across the state are in different phases of implementing that.
The state is also working with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium to make take-home testing available, which could improve testing in rural Alaska. That would be a system where people could order an STD test totally anonymously through a website, have it sent to their home, send the test away to a lab, and get the confidential results back in the mail. The take-home test should be available soon through a website called iknowmine.org. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A nonprofit organization that offers breast cancer screenings around the state is improving the accuracy and speed of services with new technology. Odette Butler, executive director of the Fairbanks-based Breast Cancer Detection Center of Alaska, says a new mobile clinic will provide digital screenings.
A mobile digital machine on a coach, on a 33-foot-long coach. Our hope is to eventually be able to have PAs volunteer like on a weekend so we can go out to save Way, for example, or any of the other businesses. It's good for the roadway and anywhere we can barge to. And when we bought it, we made sure that it would be acceptable for the barge, so we could still go like to Dutch Harbor.
Butler says digital screening is superior to the analog technology the BCDC has used in the past.
Better quality, it's quicker. We used to come back from a village and have to send in our film to Anchorage to our radiologist and then have it come back and before we got results, it would be like 2.5 weeks or 2 weeks. We can, if we're in a village where there's satellite, that we can send the images right away, we could do that. Some of the villages aren't, but still, when we get back, we will have, by the next day, we'll have the results. So it's a major thing.
Butler says that her organization will now be able to provide digital screenings to most of the 56 Alaskan communities it serves, but that the mobile unit is too big to fly into some fly-in-only communities. She says the center's next acquisition will be a smaller portable digital screening machine, but that the agency first has to pay off the $500,000 mobile unit. It's expected to be delivered in June. Coming up on Alaska News Nightly, a family plans to hit the road from Fairbanks in an old bus and has a book to sell.
When we pull into a town, the baby boomers are going to go nuts with this thing. Well, what is this? You know, and coming out and look at it, and it's going to generate some buzz for us.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Electrical costs could go down in about 20 Southeast Alaska communities if lawmakers leave local energy projects in the capital budget. They're part of a controversial package that kept the legislature from completing its business last Sunday, and they continue to be in play as the special session searches for an ending. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The regional energy list, totaling about $60 million, would help expand two existing projects, Sitka's Blue Lake and Ketchikan's Whitman Lake. It also supports exploration, design, or construction of smaller hydro facilities from Shuby Lake near Haines to Triangle Lake near Metlakatla. There's also alternative energy money for a Thorn Bay wood-powered boiler, a Tenneke Inlet geothermal development, and a Wrangell electric vehicle study. Almost all the projects could reduce the use of diesel generators, which are far more expensive than hydro. Sitka's Blue Lake expansion is the most expensive Southeast project. It's in the budget at $28.5 million, a little more than a quarter of the total cost. The project would increase the height of an existing dam and add a turbine.
It will allow us to generate more electricity over a year's time with the same amount of water.
Dean Orbison is the engineer overseeing the project for Sitka's electrical utility.
We found that with rising oil prices, people have been switching to electric heat because it's actually cheaper than oil. So our loads are increasing and we're raising the dam to meet the load.
The work will increase Sitka's hydroelectric generation capacity about 30%. A similar expansion project in Ketchikan is up for about $9 million in the capital budget, a little less than half its cost. Additional generators powered by water from Whitman Lake also target a growing electric demand, some from home heating conversions. Other projects are slated for a smaller portion of their cost. Angoon's Thayer Lake Electrical Development, for example, is down for $1 million. That's a fraction of the $15 million to $18 million total, but backers say it's important.
It's much-needed money. It matches federal funds that are already set aside and it'll get us going.
Peter Nowrose is general manager of Kootsnuwu, the village native corporation that's the project's developer. He says the state money, plus other funds, will help prepare for construction.
If done right, and that's our intent, it'll bring down the cost of power significantly and allow the community to grow and prosper.
The Reynolds Creek Hydroelectric Project on Prince of Wales Island is in the capital budget for about $2 million, and upgrades to Pelican's generation system are down for close to the same amount. Another $2 million would go to Juneau's Alaska Electric Light and Power Company to help protect power lines from avalanches. Snowslides knocked down towers from the Snettisham Hydro Project south of town twice in recent years. That increased rates as the capital city relied on diesel generators. The 20 or so Southeast energy projects total about $60 million. They're part of a $465 million statewide package assembled by the Senate Finance Committee. The largest item is $66 million towards the Susitna Hydro Project north of Anchorage. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Ice Alaska wants to buy the land it's operated on for the last 15 years. The nonprofit Ice Sculpture Organization sits on Alaska Railroad property, and the two parties have battled over lease terms for many years. Efforts to get the railroad to give the land to the North Star Borough or swap it for similarly valued property have failed, and Ice Alaska faces a June deadline to move out. Ice Alaska Chairman Dick Brickley says the organization is offering the railroad $4 million for the 30-acre site.
The state legislature approved that the Alaska Railroad can sell their ground at fair market value. That opened the doors, so we just said, gee whiz, let's make an offer for it.
Brickley says the offer is based on past railroad and borough assessments. He says Ice Alaska's financing plan uses $1.8 million the organization received from the legislature for a new building, plus a $2.2 million loan. Brickley says he'll personally guarantee the loan if he has to. He says the Alaska Railroad's Real Estate Board plans to review the proposal. Ice Alaska and the railroad have been at odds over the site for years.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
One answer to our state's declining oil production? Port McKenzie Rail Project. The link from the Alaska Railroad to a deepwater port will bring billions in mineral production and thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough.
Recent weather conditions are conducive to an easy breakup. National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum in Fairbanks says moderate temperatures are easing the interior into spring.
With temperatures climbing above freezing during the day and then dropping back down below freezing at night, we're slowly bleeding off the snowpack and melting it and slowly deteriorating or rotting the ice out that's in the rivers.
Plum says if the current trend continues, it will result in a mush out of river ice and no flooding. But he cautions that a change in the weather could quickly throw things the other way.
If we have a dramatic warming, you know, in late April, that can lead to a rapid snowmelt, and all that water runs off into the river system and then lifts the ice, and then we can have significant ice jam problems and flooding.
That's what happened in 2009 when interior temperatures abruptly climbed into the 70-degree range at the start of May, triggering a major meltdown that lifted and jammed river ice, causing major flooding along the Yukon River at Eagle. A new Southern Southeast ferry system says it's shored up the bulk of the funding necessary to begin passenger and vehicle service next April. The North End Ferry Authority plans to pick up where the Inter-Island Ferry Authority left off, resuming service between Kaufman Cove, Wrangell, and Petersburg. The Ferry Authority plans to expand the defunct IFA route to also include Ketchikan. Deanna Garrison reports from member station KRBD.
Speaking before a Ketchikan Chamber of Commerce luncheon Wednesday, Development Manager Kent Miller gave an update on the Rainforest Islands Ferry Project, which would provide year-round public ferry service between four southern southeast communities.
The Kaufman Cove Wrangell South Metcalf service will be a year-round service, four times a week in summer and three times a week in winter. The Kaufman Cove Ketchikan link will be a seasonal service, three times a week in summer.
The North End Ferry Authority had approached IFA about leasing the IFA vessel Prince of Wales for the new ferry route. That request was denied, and Miller says the plan is now to purchase a used crew boat that has been operating out of the Gulf.
It's a 155 by 30 foot boat. It has a service speed of nominally 22 knots. The timetable we've put together plans on operating that at about 18 knots. It carries 60 passengers. The seating plan is set up with 83 seats, giving people some choice of recliners. coffee shop dinette tables and then an upper viewing lounge, plus some outside seating, not in that count, on the deck. The car deck there is laid out for 12 vehicles.
In addition to ferry service, Miller says the North End Ferry Authority would provide passenger van service. The passenger vans would meet every arrival at Kaufman Cove and South Midcoff and would also meet some IFA arrivals at Hollis.
To facilitate these services, the Rainforest Island Ferry will have a road service as well, using an 11 passenger Mercedes Sprinter, which will pull a trailer for baggage and parcel express. That'll make it possible for people to cover these travel alternatives on short or long itineraries without taking a vehicle.
Miller says the Ferry Authority has lined up a $2.5 million loan from GE Capital to purchase and overhaul the vessel and make necessary changes to the Kaufman Cove terminal. He says the Ferry Authority is attempting to secure the remaining $185,000 it believes is necessary to get the project up and running.
The boat has to carry debt service, and therefore it has to operate with a much sharper pencil.
The IFA-operated round-trip summer service between Kaufman Cove, Wrangell, and South Midcoff between 2006 and 2008. Low usage forced the Ferry Authority to suspend what it called its northern route. So why does the North End Ferry Authority believe it can succeed on nearly the same route that the IFA failed? Miller says the addition of Ketchikan creates a travel loop that should attract more passengers.
In addition to restoring the IFA service between Kaufman Cove and the ports of Wrangell and South Midcoff, the service will be extended to Ketchikan, creating new travel opportunities and giving better access to Prince of Wales for a larger market. Also, it will be marketed in conjunction with links and packages that use IFA and Marine Highway. So it's intended to address a larger market for ferry service than IFA was capable of addressing at that time. And it will also facilitate it by using the shoreside transportation to facilitate the walk-on passengers traffic. It'll run year-round, and there's a year-round market.
He says upgrades to the Kaufman Cove Road should also help drive up ferry traffic. Miller says the McDowell Group completed a traffic and revenue study for the ferry project, showing the new service could in fact be profitable.
Interestingly, they used a model based on IFA's weekly traffic in 2007 when IFA operated from May through November. That makes a very workable low case for this new ferry operation.
In order to cover its costs, Miller says the new ferry must carry approximately 30% more traffic than what the IFA was able to achieve on its northern route. The North End Ferry Authority plans to begin operating the Rainforest Islander on April 1st of next year. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
A family that rode a five-person bicycle into Fairbanks last fall has more than survived the winter. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the Kentucky clan has big plans for the future.
The Harrisons, who go by the nickname Pedowins, like pedaling nomads, have been off the bike for 9 months. Bill and Amarins and their three young daughters spent the winter in a cabin on the outskirts of Fairbanks, living without running water, electricity, or a car. It's been a new challenge, but Amarin says they've enjoyed the Fairbanks experience.
I actually think this is the best well-kept secret of the planet. This winter, I mean, it's just, we lived in fairy tale paradise. I mean, just the snow on the trees and like going out to the outhouse, but you know, you see the stars, everywhere.
The Harrisons say things worked out after a rough start in Fairbanks. The family was criticized by some locals last fall who saw the pedaling clan as freeloaders because of their donor and barter-supported lifestyle. Bill works off and on as a mechanic, carpenter, and laborer, but the family largely survives on the generosity of people who admire their adventurous spirit. The Harrisons have supporters across the country, and they say Fairbanks has followed suit.
Despite those few criticisms we got,
in the beginning,
people were so incredibly helpful, incredibly helpful, and they still are. You know, we are borrowing cars from the Kleins, and the Underwoods put us up, and Muttley and Jennifer, they gave us rides and helped us get water and lent us a little money when we needed from time to time. It's just been amazing how, and of course, we've given back and helped work on cars and do things for people, too, so it's been a two-way street, but it's been amazing how they have helped.
Yeah, and you found some work here and there every now and then, so that was good, too, to make it through the winter.
Oh, yeah, I had to eat.
The Harrisons are industrious people and subtle self-promoters. They maintain a website where they share their stories and pictures and take donations. Their winter project was a book about their adventures and, according to Bill, an endeavor that may have been tougher than pedaling across the country.
Here we're in a 24x20 cabin trying to do something that I dislike vehemently, even though I needed to do it, and then having the kids chatter on top and living on top of each other and having to plug in our bed or get the candles just right so I could see to write or type. You know, it was just the logistics were nuts and then my own internal stuff going on. Of course, you know, and then that made us grouch at each other a little bit. You know, those tensions flared up. But we didn't shoot each other. And we.
The self-published book, A Pedouin Life, is nearing completion and the family is preparing to sell it on a cross-country tour in a vintage bus. The Harrisons, who homeschool their daughters, say the whole family has helped realize the latest dream.
We needed to buy this 1960 Chevy bus. We didn't have the money, and the girls came up with a great idea. 3, 5, and 7 years old, they said, let's make purses with the treadle sewing machine, sell them online. And in 2 months, they sold 47 purses and made $2,200, and the bus was only $500. So they paid to have it towed up, the title, a set of tires, and bought the bus. So they owned the bus. At 3, 5, and 7, they're entrepreneurs. It's just stunning.
The Harrisons are awaiting the arrival of a new engine and other parts donated by friends across the country. Bill Harrison says their 5-person bike will be fitted on the side of the faded 50-year-old Air Force bus for what they're calling the Blue Collar Book Tour.
When we pull into a town, the baby boomers are going to go nuts with this thing. Well, what is this? You know, and coming out and look at it, and it's going to generate some buzz for us, you know, with that yellow bike hanging on the side of it. And then those 3 girls coming out with their table set up to sell some books. It's going to be successful.
The Harrisons plan to kick off the book tour on the summer solstice in Fairbanks, then head south on a trip that hits every state in the lower 48. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Anchorage School District has fired 4 employees suspected of stealing lunch money, student activity fees, or other cash used by students to pay for expenses. Superintendent Carol Como says the district was tipped off by other employees about possible thefts or complaints that fees had been paid but not credited. She says that led to an investigation and the district is working with Anchorage police to review other possible patterns of larceny. The 4 employees were working individually. Police say one of the 4, a former Chugiak High School administrative assistant, has been charged with felony theft and falsifying business records. The district has fired another Chugiak High employee, plus 1 each at West High and O'Malley Elementary School. And that's all for Alaska News Nightly. We had stories tonight from Daisha Eaton in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. Dave Waldron is our technical engineer, Annie Feit is our producer, and I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com.
And by
AT&T. Rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.